They say Social Security is broken, but is it?
We actually can not only close the potential deficit in the 2030s, we could actually afford to double the Social Security monthly benefit for all Americans.
That's Stephen Hill. We talk with him about his book, Expand Social Security Now. Then the election is next week. Is every vote equal?
You don't make very much money selling a voting machine once every 15 years for the lowest bid. You can make a lot of money selling elections.
That's Beverly Harris of Black Box Voting. We talk with her about new research she's published claiming voting machines are counting some votes as worth more than others. Finally, we get the long perspective from historian Tracy Campbell, author of Deliver the Vote, A History of Election Fraud and American Political Tradition. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us at this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Whether it's the charge that greedy geezers are robbing the next generation or hand-wringing over the national debt, pundits and politicians in both parties have been claiming for years that we have to cut Social Security. The attacks on what's been called America's most effective anti-poverty program have abated slightly this election season, thanks largely to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But my guest Stephen Hill says, don't heave a sigh of relief just yet. We still have to see if the attacks will resume after Election Day. 40% of retirees depend entirely on Social Security for their income, but the benefits are barely above poverty level, averaging about $1,500 a month. Most Americans want to expand Social Security, and that includes most Republicans. So why is it under attack? That question is answered in Hill's book, Expand Social Security Now. He also explodes the myths being spread about Social Security and shows how we can strengthen it for current and future generations. Stephen Hill is the author of 5 books in addition to Expand Social Security Now. He's a senior fellow with the New America Foundation. Stephen Hill, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's my great pleasure.
Expand Social Security Now. This is very timely. Actually, last night I heard Bernie Sanders say that there was a time not so long ago when Social Security was under threat, that the threat has been beaten back, and that now people in the Congress and the Democratic Party are talking about expanding Social Security. Are you as sanguine as he is?
Yes and no. Certainly the conversation has changed dramatically compared to where it was even 5 years ago when you had President Barack Obama, who appointed a commission whose job was to figure out how to cut Social Security, either increasing the retirement age or, you know, decreasing the cost of living adjustment. That was what was in the works. And so now recently President Obama has announced his support for expanding Social Security, and so that's a big step. Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, has been kind of a waffler on this issue, because Bernie Sanders has been pushing her. She recently has said she will sort of go along with expanding Social Security, but only for those people who need it the most, which in her definition of that means not very many people at all. But the Republicans who control Congress, and after the November election, very good chance they'll still control at least one house of Congress. They are committed to cutting Social Security, and depending on who ends up as president, of course, things could be dramatically different. So this is, I think it's a good time for people to be pushing on this issue to expand Social Security, but I don't think anything is safe or secure at all.
In fact, there has been a bipartisan effort to cut Social Security, and I just read today there was an article in The Intercept by David Dayan that suggested that Wall Streeter Larry Fink is positioning himself for the job of Secretary of Treasury, and I just want to quote from this. Fink has promoted the privatization of Social Security while mocking the idea of retiring at 65, and he owes his initial backing at BlackRock, which is where he's from, the big hedge fund, to Pete Peterson. Tell us who Pete Peterson is and why it might be very concerning, even if Hillary Clinton is president, if she appoints Larry Fink as Treasury Secretary.
Pete Peterson was temporarily a Secretary of the Treasury under the first President Bush, and then went on to Wall Street to make billions of dollars in the usual ways on Wall Street, and then took that money and started putting it into his own personal campaign against Social Security and what he calls entitlement, Social Security, Medicare. He even founded his own foundation, the Peterson Foundation, which is dedicated to basically undermining Social Security. He hasn't necessarily come out in favor of privatization. You know, there's different wings of the anti-Social Security movement, but he has put a lot of money into fronting other organizations, one called Fix the Debt, for example, and they always frame it in terms of the country is going broke, we can't afford this anymore. And they've even given money to front groups to target young people, saying, you know, these are the old greedy geezers who are stealing from young people and from the legacy that young people are going to enjoy. So he's really put a lot of money behind this effort to basically try and cut back Social Security, not necessarily to privatize it. There are others out there, though, who certainly want to privatize it. And President George W. Bush had a plan to privatize that he went around and tried to sell to the country. It was a plan designed by Karl Rove, but he basically found that the country wasn't buying it. Not only do most Americans support Social Security, but even 70% of rank-and-file Republicans support Social Security. So that was sort of a tipping point once they weren't able to do that. And then people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren now have pushed expansion of Social Security back onto the table. So that's where we are now, where all these different options are on the table. Which one is going to win? That's what we have to figure out, and that's what we have to push forward for to make sure that the right one wins and not the wrong ones.
Tell us why it is so critical at this time to not only protect Social Security, but to expand it. I mean, not just for now, but for retirees coming up, for the young people today who will be retirees at one point.
Well, here's the reality of our retirement system that, you know, the cutters and the privatizers and all, and, you know, both Democrats and Republicans just aren't willing or don't want to face. The retirement system for Americans in the post-World War II era was founded on what we call the three-legged stool of retirement. And those three legs were Social Security, another leg was company pensions, private pensions, and then a third leg was private savings, which for most people centered around home ownership. You know, you had a home, and that home is going to be used in a way that you could use that during your retirement. So when you look at these three stools, what you see is that two of the three legs have become extremely wobbly. Private retirement pensions barely exist anymore. 60% of U.S. workers used to be covered by them. Now it's only 10%. They've been replaced for the most part by IRAs and 401ks. That was sold to Americans as this is the new, improved, more modern way of doing this. And in fact, it turned out not to be true at all. IRAs and 401ks went from covering 17% of Americans now to 65 to 70% of Americans. But the reality is that most Americans, because wages have been flat for three decades, haven't been able to save enough money to put into their 401ks and their IRAs. So, you know, President Obama and others who are calling for a universal 401k, because a lot of people work at companies and for businesses that don't offer a 401k, so they want to create a universal one where every American will be able to have access to it. That would be great, except for the fact that if you don't have enough money to save, it really doesn't do you any good. It's a waste of time. And then the third leg of private savings around home ownership, well, we saw what happened to that in the 2008-2009 crisis, where we lost, you know, the housing market collapsed and we lost $8 trillion in housing wealth. Nearly 10 million Americans, a fifth of all homeowners, are still what we call underwater. Their home is worth less than the mortgage they are paying on it. They are essentially bankrupt. So this is the state of the U.S. retirement system. Basically, Social Security has emerged as the most stable leg for most Americans for the retirement system. And in fact, three-quarters of Americans depend heavily on Social Security in their elderly years. Nearly half would be living in poverty without it. And it's especially important to women and to racial minorities. 90% or more of income for 55% of elderly Hispanics comes from Social Security, 49% for African Americans, 42% for Asian Americans. So these are pretty telling numbers. What it boils down to is that more and more Americans are relying almost solely on Social Security for their retirement. And so what we start realizing, the problem with Social Security is not that it's going broke, as some of the critics are saying, and that, you know, they'll cite you numbers saying by 2034 there won't be enough money to pay out all benefits, which is true if we don't do anything. But we've been in this situation before, and we've made adjustments. But what the reality is, that what you start realizing is that the bigger threat to Social Security is that it's too stingy, that for most Americans, it's going to replace about 40% of your final wages, 40% of what you are making when you go to retire. That's what Social Security is going to replace. And yet all the experts tell us that you're going to need almost twice that amount to not have a drastic reduction in your standard of living. And yet most Americans haven't been able to save because the wages are too low and home ownership turned out to not be the great deal in terms of retirement that we thought it was going to be. So that's where I come to the conclusion, and people like Bernie Sanders and others have come to the conclusion, that we need to expand Social Security because it's stable, it's been reliable, it's really cost effective. The administrative fees for this are far less than what Wall Street charges to administer your 401ks and IRAs. And on top of that, it's a very efficient way of keeping the economy going, because if you are a retiree and you have this money used for your retirement, you're going to spend that money. You're going to spend it on the needs that you have during your retirement. And so that becomes an ongoing consumer spending stimulus to the economy. So Social Security actually plays a role of what we call an automatic stabilizer for the economy by providing this type of ongoing stimulus. So it's not only good for retirees, but it's good for businesses because they have customers spending money, and it's good for the broader macro economy. It's just a win-win-win everywhere you look. It's just a matter of figuring out how do we expand it in a way that is going to not bankrupt the country. And that's doable. That's what I show in my book, Expand Social Security Now.
And we're talking with Stephen Hill. As you just heard, his book is Expand Social Security Now, How to Ensure Americans Get the Retirement They Deserve. Now, a little bit on the figures, you talk about how inadequate Social Security is now and likely to be in the future, where medical costs and housing costs are going through the roof. What is the average income from Social Security that people are depending on?
The average American earns about, I think the latest figures was about $1,500 a month from Social Security. So that's about $18,000 a year. It's not that much. And as I said, it's only replacing about 40% of your final wage. The maximum that you can earn is about $2,600 a month. But to earn that, you'd have to be making over the maximum amount of income that you pay into with Social Security with for many, many years. So most people don't really reach that, but some do. Most people are more around the, you know, $1,500 or $1,300 to $2,000 level.
Yeah, and it almost sounds, well, it does sound quite regressive. You know, you say in this book, Expand Social Security Now, that Social Security is, unlike much of the rest of the tax system, is a regressive tax. Explain that.
Yes, that's right. You know, the way Social Security works is that everyone pays 6.2% of your wages, your earnings, into the Social Security Trust Fund, and then your employer pays another 6.2%. But if someone makes above $118,500 a year, at that point, you don't pay the Social Security tax on wages above $118,500. So the practical effect of what that means is that, you know, someone who's a millionaire banker, hedge fund manager, or whatever it is, they're paying far less than 1% of their earnings into Social Security. They're paying a lower percentage into Social Security than their doorman, their secretary, their chauffeurs. And so this is, you know, other tax systems don't work this way. For example, Medicare puts the same percentage on all Americans regardless of their income. It's only Social Security that is treated differently in this way. You know, we can look at data showing how much of the nation's wealth is being captured for Social Security purposes. It used to be about 90% of all earnings and wages in the U.S. would be taxed for Social Security purposes. Now it's down to about 83%. And so that's why there is potentially a deficit in 2034, because less of the country's wages are being captured for Social Security. And that's because you have this big gap in earnings in inequality in the United States, where more Americans are earning above that $118,500, and they're not paying into the system on those wages above that amount. And so this is a big problem, that we're not capturing enough of the nation's wages to put into the Social Security Trust Fund.
So just to connect the dots here, you've got a hedge fund manager like Larry Flynt at BlackRock, who pays maybe less than 1% of his income into Social Security. When he retires, he's going to get the maximum amount out of Social Security. And yet he's the one calling for raising the retirement age, cutting of benefits, and privatization of Social Security.
Yeah, exactly. In a nutshell, that's exactly right. I mean, the CEO of Goldman Sachs has called for cutting Social Security. You know, we can't afford this. And it's like, well, actually, we can. As I identify in my book, there's quite a few ways. If we just close the tax loopholes and deductions that are vastly disproportionately favoring wealthier Americans like the CEO of Goldman Sachs and these other people, we actually can not only close the potential deficit in the 2030s, we could actually afford to double the Social Security monthly benefit for all Americans. I mean, it's just a matter of budget priorities. There are infinite ways to close the gap and to expand Social Security. It's really a matter of your priorities as a society. And that's what you realize when you get further into this conversation, is that this isn't just about actuarial tables and number crunching and all these sorts of things. This is about who we are as a society and where we choose to put the incredible amount of wealth that is in this country, you know, what our priorities are.
So the nine biggest myths, we've touched on some of them, but we can go a little bit more deeply into them. Social Security is going broke and will bankrupt the country. Why is that a myth?
Well, it's a myth because, for one, Social Security is one of the few government programs that actually has its own dedicated funding. And by law, Social Security cannot pay out more than it's bringing in. So, I mean, in worst case scenario, in 2034, the number that, you know, the date that everyone has picked out is Armageddon Doomsday for retirement. Worst case scenario, we would have to reduce benefits by about 20 to 25%. But it's not like people are going to get nothing for everything that they've paid into. That's just not factual at all. And yet you see this myth being put out there. It's going broke. You know, young people are not going to get the money that they're paying into it now. It's going to be sucked up by the greedy geezers and there'll be nothing left for them. There's just no factual basis to it at all. And as I said, even before 2034, there's a ton of things that we could do to make sure that we shore up Social Security and even can expand it.
What you're saying is expand it, that we're not going to shore it up by cutting it, which seems to have been the prescription up till now.
Right. That's exactly what people are saying. I mean, and keep in mind that when they say we're going to raise the retirement age to 70 years old, that's a cut. Mm-hmm. That's a cut in Social Security. It means fewer benefits for you.
And especially workers who, you know, may have worked in manual labor all their lives, who tend to die. And in fact, I believe that life expectancy is going down in the United States, not up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, latest figures I've seen for life expectancy, I think it was 76 for males. So, you know, at 70, that means, you know, American men would be able to collect their Social Security for 6 years on average, and then they would be dead. Mm-hmm. So, to me, it's just not an option. Seems to me that, you know, we've already raised the retirement age to 67. It hasn't really even kicked in yet, and they're already talking about raising it to 70. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people who are talking about doing this, of course, are people who are going to be quite secure in their retirement years. It's really, you know, they're talking about doing this for people who aren't secure in their retirement years, and that's what I really have a problem with.
Okay, myth number two, and For our listeners, we are talking with Stephen Hill. He's the author of the new book, Expand Social Security Now, How to Ensure Americans Get the Retirement They Deserve. So number two on the list is Social Security is unsustainable because we have fewer workers for every retiree, even as our society is graying and people are living longer, even though poorer people are not living longer.
Well, this is something that they've always been talking about declining birth rates, you know, and that there'll be fewer workers paying into the Social Security Trust Fund who will be supporting more retirees. The reality is that, you know, we have what's called a dependency ratio. How many workers do you have for every dependent? And dependent aren't just retirees, but also children, basically anybody who's not paying into the fund. And the dependency ratio now is about three workers for every one dependent. And the projections are that it's going to go at some point to two workers for every one dependent. But the reality is that at one point, you know, it used to be the dependency ratio was about 18 to 1 back in the 1960s. And it has been much higher where there were a lot more dependents for every worker. And so the way we were able to manage that transition was that we increased labor productivity. More workers are able to accomplish more with things like automation and mechanization. And so, you know, we should be able to make this transition just fine as long as we keep up labor productivity and as long as we have our budget priorities in the right way. I don't see that this is going to be a big issue, but this is another myth that they like to put out there that there's going to be too few workers for the number of dependents. And, you know, I should point out also that other countries around the world that have, you know, have even fewer workers to dependents than we have, they've been able to make this transition simply by having very efficient retirement systems and having good budget priorities.
Now, number three on the nine biggest myths and lies about Social Security is about IRAs and 401ks. As you pointed out, they've replaced private pensions by and large in this country. And the argument is that Americans want to be self-reliant. You can do better investing on your own. I mean, it's a little hard for this one to pass a smell test after 2007, but go ahead. tell us about this.
Yeah, you still hear that you know, Americans, you know, we don't believe in big government and we can figure out a way to, you know, let Americans invest on their own. But, you know, I mean, investing in the stock market, because let's face it, we're making money on interest rates anymore, on CDs and market funds and these sorts of things. So you have to invest in the stock market. And, you know, what a casino that turned out to be, right? And even putting it into your home turned out to be a bit of a casino. So the reality is that I mean, sure, if you have expendable income and you want to gamble it in the stock market, you know, long-term projections, if you have time to put it in and leave it there for a while, usually you make out okay. But you have to have enough expendable income to do that kind of thing. And a lot of Americans just don't have it. And if they do have some, they don't want to risk it on something like the stock market. So, you know, this is what the 401k and IRAs was predicated on, was the idea that you'd have private savings and you'd be able to invest that in a way that would grow this stockpile of money that you have. Well, I mean, it clearly did not work out very well. And some of it depends on where the economy is. The economy cycles. It goes up and down. So if you happen to retire when the economy is up and your stocks have done well, then it's going to work for you. But what about those who wanted to retire in 2009 and 2010 when everyone had lost 40% of what they had saved? I know people personally who were in that situation. It's just not a smart way to base a huge amount of your retirement system on such a volatile system like that.
Right. And the next one you referred to, and you use the term greedy geezers, the idea that it's stealing from young people. Now, tell us, why would young people actually be in favor of expanding Social Security?
Well, one, if we expand it, and in my proposal of how to expand it, I'm not asking for the nation to put any more money into our retirement system than we're already doing right now. So it's not about paying more in taxes. It's about using what we already have in a more efficient way to double the monthly benefits. So it would clearly benefit younger people by having twice as much money in their retirement years. But also, this argument is just kind of silly, because, I mean, if we were to follow that logic in all policy areas. For example, why should young people help fund cancer research? Because most people who get cancer tend to be elderly people. Some young people do, but not very much. So, you know, you could make an argument, well, by having everybody, the federal government, fund cancer research, that means young people's taxes are going towards that. They're funding something that really isn't going to be used for them. But we know that someday those young people are going to be older people, and then they might have cancer. So that's why you fund things today that maybe you aren't going to need until tomorrow. And you know, just as young people, the young people of yesterday are now the elderly retirees of today, those young people of today will one day be retirees themselves. So it's just penny-wise and pound-foolish to not have enough vision to fund things that you're going to need in the future in a way that's going to be more cost-effective and is going to help you in your retirement. If you think about someone who makes the average of $1,500 a month from Social Security, about $18,000 a year, well, if you're retired over 20 years' time from 65 to 85, that $18,000 a year is going to translate into, you know, almost $500,000. You'd have to save that in another fashion, you know, either through your IRA or 401k or throwing into the stock market. You'd have to come up with that amount of money in another fashion in order to replace what you're going to get from Social Security. And so when you think about it from that perspective, you realize Social Security is actually a pretty darn good deal for a lot of people. And the other thing I would add about that point is that when you look at other countries that have more generous retirement systems that are paying out twice as much, you know, more like 70, 75% of final wages compared to 40% in the United States, you also see that those same countries are the ones that put more money also into children's services, into services for teens, and that sort of thing. So this is not a zero-sum game. You can pay for this or you can pay for that, but you can't pay for both, because other countries are demonstrating that you actually can pay for both. It really, again, comes back to what are your budget priorities, what are your values as a society.
And also, we should point out that Social Security isn't just for elders. A lot of it funds Social Security disability, which also goes to children.
Disabilities, survivors, widow benefits, all sorts of things like that. This is true.
Right. And, you know, another point I'd like to make is when my mother, when I had to take care of my mother, it was, you know, it really eased my worries to know that she was getting Social Security and therefore I didn't have to pay for things. It was covered by her Social Security and also her savings. If there hadn't been that Social Security, there would have been a huge bite out of her budget.
Yeah, helping seniors who are retired and, you know, doubling their monthly benefit helps families because now they have more money. Their children don't have to worry about helping them so much and can focus more on just giving them services and, you know, being around for them and just having a loving relationship and not being stressed out about money over this thing.
Okay, now we're going to skip ahead a little bit on these nine biggest myths and lies about Social Security. This one's an interesting one. I have to confess I haven't heard it, but I'm sure it's pretty current in some right-wing circles. That's number seven. Social Security is un-American and too socialistic for most people in the United States. Of course, now that Bernie Sanders has given socialism a good name, maybe this one will get retired.
Right, and it was just one of these myths that never really had much substance to it because, as I said earlier, 70% of Republicans don't want it to be cut or hurt in any way. The reality is that now more and more Americans depend on Social Security for their retirement years. I mean, the bottom 40% of Americans income-wise depend on it almost exclusively. And even the top 20 to 40% of income earners still get about half of their retirement income from Social Security. So it's only the top 20% of income earners in the United States that don't really depend quite heavily on Social Security. You know, if this is socialism, then Americans must be socialists.
Well, let's go on to solutions now. You've talked about some of them in terms of solvency. You also talk about something called Social Security Plus.
So Social Security Plus is the name that I've given to new version of Social Security in which we not only expand Social Security, but we are actually going to double the monthly benefit. And the reason why I picked double was because, as I said earlier, Social Security is geared to replace about 40% of your pre-retirement wages. And experts tell us you're going to need nearly twice that amount for your retirement. So my way of thinking is let's get us closer to what you're actually going to need in your retirement years, and that's why I called for a doubling of the Social Security benefit. And I show how we can pay for it. There are numerous tax loopholes, tax deductions in the federal budget that if we close those loopholes, we could easily get to the $662 billion a year, which is a lot of money, but we could get to that figure and more by closing a lot of these tax loopholes.
And how much would be closed by just simply raising the cap and allowing all income being taxed for on Social Security?
If we simply get rid of the payroll cap, which is how Medicare is funded, there's no payroll cap on Medicare, we would raise about $135 billion right there, boom, towards the $600 billion that we need to double the Social Security payout.
Go to writersvoice.net to hear an exclusive web extra where Hill explains just how we can change our tax system to save and expand Social Security. Next up, we hear about election machine coding that may be giving more weight to some votes than others. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Listeners to this program know that ever since I worked as a poll worker in the New York presidential primary election this spring, I've been concerned about the fairness of our elections. Unlike Donald Trump, however, I'm not worried about voter fraud, but I am worried about other threats to our election system, like voter suppression and the possibility that our antiquated voting machines may be vulnerable to manipulation. That's why Bev Harris's new research caught my attention. She's the director of BlackBoxVoting.org, a nonpartisan investigative reporting and public education organization about elections. Harris says she's uncovered evidence of a code built right into the vast majority of voting machines in America that makes it possible to weight the votes of different Americans differently by assigning fractions to them. It's like Animal Farm. There, all animals were equal, but some were more equal than others. Here, all votes are equal, but some are more equal than others. Harris says some votes, especially those of minority voters, are being assigned values of less than one, while other votes are getting values greater than one. Seems unbelievable, doesn't it? Well, I called up Bev Harris to find out more about this fractionalized voting. Well, Bev Harris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
So tell us, what is fractionalized voting?
Well, what it is very simple. Votes should be a whole number, a whole number being 1, 2, 3, 4, one person, one vote. Fractional counts mean that when you cast one vote, it can be counted as 1.567 or 0.702. It can be counted as more than or less than one.
And how did you discover the fractionalized voting issue?
Over the course of a number of years, I have been involved in gathering records for a bunch of different election lawsuits and so forth. And one particular lawsuit, I got an especially large amount of files. A programmer by the name of Benny Smith ultimately came to look at those files, and he called me along with an election commissioner from that county to tell me that they had found something that they felt was significant. And so after that, I actually spent about a year verifying each part of the findings, and I saw how serious it was and actually realized that this is kind of the magic key that enables very sophisticated, invisible alteration of votes on a very wide scale throughout the U.S.
Could you say more about how it works?
Yeah, essentially, you don't know how many people are going to show up to vote. So if you start trying to manipulate an election by saying, I'm just going to add 100 or I'm going to flip every third vote or something, you're going to end up with some strange math because you're going to make miscalculations as to how many people showed up. So the better and more sophisticated way to do it would be to say, of the votes that show up, however many they are, I'm going to have my candidate get X% of those votes. Now, the minute you do that, you create votes that are not whole numbers. And it's a very simple thing to understand, even if you're not a math fan. If you have 100 votes and you have and you say, I want 43% of the votes to go to the other guy, that's 43 votes. But if you have 99 voters show up, it's going to end up 42-point-something-something votes. It's not going to end up a whole number. And so anytime you allocate votes by a percentage that you set ahead of time, you're going to produce votes that have decimal places in them. And so what was surprising and inappropriate that was found in the system was that it used to be set to count votes as whole numbers. There's a setting that you put in the database that tells you whether you want it to be whole numbers or decimals. But they changed the setting, so it was a conscious decision, and they did so nationwide, and they changed the setting to change it so that it counts all votes with decimal places. What it did was enable allocation of votes by percent.
Who is they, however, and they. How can they do something nationwide? We have different election districts, thousands of them over the whole country. We've got different voting machines. So why are you making the assumption that something is being done to these machines? Who is doing it?
Oh, the vendor did it. There's only three manufacturers, and at this point, two of the three manufacturers actually share a voting system. So what it was the programmers, and at that time, the supervisor of the programmers, he was the head of research and actually was the main stockholder in the company, directed that they change the system so that it would accept fractional votes. And they did it. This at that time was a company called Global Election Systems. Global Election Systems was then bought by Diebold Election Systems, which was then bought by ES&S and Dominion, two different voting companies. And so the fractional counting software migrated from company to company to company. But it was initially put in there by a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Dean under his supervision, and the programmer notes show that, as does the testimony in a lawsuit, because one of his programmers, he didn't pay them their bonus, so they sued him. So everybody talked in sworn testimony about who did what. So at any rate, he put the fractional counts in there, and that enabled allocation of votes, and then that spread from vendor to vendor. And at this point, all three major vendors have fractional counting.
Now, why would they do this?
Why would they say they did it? Well, they said they did it so they would have the ability to produce weighted races, W-E-I-G-H-T, weight the races. They further describe a weighted race as a race in which one vote is not one person, that they can count some people as more than others.
But why would they weight the races? One would think that someone who produces a voting machine would want to advertise the incorruptibility of that machine, not the corruptibility of it.
Well, you know, here's one other way to look at it. You don't make very much money selling a voting machine once every 15 years for the lowest bid. You can make a lot of money selling elections. So essentially, whatever the reason is they put it in there, the end result is it enabled them to allocate votes by percent and do very sophisticated election tampering. Now, my theory is that this was designed for tampering with elections at the local level. Now, a lot of people, and so that they could actually sell elections as the product. In other words, they weren't selling voting machines, they were selling a service. The presidential election rolls around only once every 4 years. But there are 100,000 local elections every year. So if you want to go for a repeat purchase, you're not going to go for the national. You're going to go for all these locals. And the motivation to change the results in a local election has a lot to do with money. Hundreds of billions of dollars in contracts are authorized due to whoever gets the local office. Anything from landfill to water rights to development rights, all those kinds of really big-ticket items. Someone wants to build a stadium. They want to pass a bond for something or other. Those are the kinds of things that are very tempting targets for someone who would wish to purchase an election as opposed to win it in the fair and square way.
But it isn't candidates who buy election voting machines. It's election districts, which tend to be both Republican and Democratic. So how does that work to sell
it? Oh, it's not the voting machine or the county that does it, though. Here's how it really works. A lot of people are not clear on this. They buy the system, but they don't usually even administer their own system. Because when you think about it, you know, there's 3,000 different jurisdictions, different clerks and counties and so forth. They are not going to be an expert in how to run a very specialized kind of computer voting system that they only use once a year. So what they do, and it makes perfect sense, is they hire out, and there are various kinds of middlemen and kind of local contract jobbers, and they all, you know, like Bill's Election Service. This is for real. They really have places like this. The guy works out of his home, and his deal is he comes in and he performs a service, and he does all of the programming and running of the computer side of the election. So, yes, the county owns the equipment, but typically they don't actually run their own equipment. And so the individual who is in a position to sell elections to whoever shows up to him and knows where he is actually that middleman, that subcontractor. And some of these guys are completely off the books. They're very hard to find, but once you find them, they have some sort of dodgy pasts. For example, one of the people who does this kind of work is a convicted narcotics trafficker. So it's not quite the wonderful, shiny machine that people think it is. The elections industry is actually run by a bunch of little local guys who have a contract and they are given inside access because the local election official actually does not know how to run their own system. And it's probably unreasonable to ask them to learn it, all this new stuff. And the other big thing is the vendors. There's three major vendors, and each of them have and remote access privileges, so they can remote in to the computers. So when they make this big thing about it might be the Russians and it's not connected to the internet and blah, 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 what they're omitting is that the vendor, for example, ESNS, which counts 60% of the votes in the United States, has people on staff who already have permission to do remote desktop access. And the bottom line is you've got at least 5,000 different people who have inside access to various jurisdictions and sometimes whole regions and sometimes states. And if you're just going to say we're just going to turn it over to these 5,000 people and we're going to hope that every single one of the 5,000 is completely, you know, a straight arrow. The problem is it doesn't matter if the commission is honest or not honest, Democrat or Republican, bipartisan. They don't know what the person is doing. They cannot see the programming.
Okay, so I've gone to your website, Bev Harris, and it's pretty convincing. You give evidence of emails that were subpoenaed in court that show that this fractional voting happens. But I'm still trying to figure out what's the connection between the people who are running this software and the political operatives who want it to go their way.
It would be different election by election. In fact, I conceive of it like a good ground game could simply be having access to the local fixers. Now, that goes back way back in our history, you know, to before there were voting machines. We have always had a little bit of a culture. It's sort of woven into the fabric of our election system where, in, for example, the 1960 election, you had an operative with the Kennedy campaign getting off an airplane in West Virginia with a satchel full of cash. That's very documented. There's nothing mysterious about that. That happened. And so, in other words, we've had these local yokels that do stuff for 100 years, and all the voting machines do is sort of change the way they do it and the mechanism for it. It's been for a very long time that if somebody needed to influence a local election, they would go to the guy who did it if they happened to have the contacts to know who that guy or gal is.
That is...
It's blackboxvoting.org. And certainly before we sign off, the exciting news is there really are solutions right now for this. And it's better solutions than we've ever had because the current voting systems, even the touch screens, make ballot images, in other words, with the paper ballots. They take a picture, a photo of every ballot, and that photo is an electronic record that should be subject to freedom of information and public records. And so when we did fraction magic to tamper with races in our demonstration, we found that these ballot images did not get tampered with. It didn't know how to do it. How did it allocate 47.5% of a vote to, you know, how did it even do that on the ballot images? So I think one of the very useful things is for people to ask for all the ballot images so we could essentially do our own recounts if we want. And it's a good solution, especially if you combine that with the ability to actually inspect the physical ballot, because then you can tamper your little heart out, but if the ballot images don't match, you have a problem.
Well, Bev Harris, your site is called blackboxvoting.org, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about fractionalized voting.
Thank you.
Find a link to Bev Harris's new research at writersvoice.net. Donald Trump's made a lot of self-serving claims that the elections will be rigged, entirely without evidence. But it turns out that America does have a long history of election fraud, dating from before the Revolution, and it's been a robustly bipartisan affair. It also has disproportionately hurt minority voters, and this election may be no different. Historian Tracy Campbell is the author of the acclaimed book Deliver the Vote, A History of Election Fraud and American Political Tradition, 1742 to 2004, published by Basic Books in 2005. We spoke to him at length about this history and his concerns that Trump's claims muddy the waters, but we only have time for an edited version of that conversation. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview. Tracy Campbell is professor of history at the University of Kentucky. He defines election fraud as the willful intent to cheat a free and fair election. Well, Tracy Campbell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is Deliver the Vote, The History of Election Fraud in American Political Tradition, 17. You actually talk about a culture of corruption in our elections that has existed since before the U.S. became an independent country. Give us a brief overview of some of the ways that election fraud has been endemic in our elections since the beginning.
Well, it's been endemic because, of course, there's so much on the line, and we see it today. I kind of equate it to, say, playing baseball, and that players are going to try and do what they can do in order to gain advantage. And if the umpires don't see it, then all the better, right? And so what I started out doing was actually a book on the 20th century, and it kept going. I couldn't just stop at 1900. I had to keep going back and back and back, and the sources just kind of led me where it had to go. And so we've seen throughout American history this kind of culture that sees the opposite side as being not quite as American as we are, and we can define that in any way we want. And so throughout American history, there's been this constant struggle to enlarge the right to vote, to give it to various groups who were denied it when we started the country. And that struggle keeps going on.
Well, Tracy Campbell, give us some examples where election fraud happened.
Keep in mind, almost all elections occur at a local or a state level, right? A presidential election is our only national election. So most elections are done really at the precinct level or the district, the state level. I'll give you a couple. Let's look at Louisville, Kentucky in 1905, which had an election that was so thoroughly stolen that the state Supreme Court came in and threw out all the results of it. We had a mayor of Louisville who put polling places on railroad cars so he could move them around during the day if he saw the lines of his opponents getting too long. He simply invalidated the results. He paid police officers to go around and beat people up. He canceled an election in midday because he didn't think it was going well and simply resorted to a door-by-door canvass the next day. And if you really want to see the ugliest kind of election and the most dangerous that can possibly happen, look at Wilmington, North Carolina in the 1890s. We saw thugs going through streets trying to beat and kill and intimidate anybody that they saw would be voting against them. And the governor of the state later said, you know, we've ruled by force, we've ruled by fraud, we'd like to rule by law. So that they just kind of codified that kind of election fraud and intimidation and violence into the very law so that they could suppress people from voting. Mainly in North Carolina, it was African Americans.
Now, you also talk about elections in the 20th century. Let's talk about one that affected Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter has called America's election system, the current one, deeply flawed. And he had personal experience of that.
Georgia was a case in which they used the county unit system. And it brings a question I think we should all think about. How should elections be counted? Should everybody just be counted as one individual vote? Because with the Electoral College, it's a little different. And in Georgia, Jimmy Carter had to fight even to get elected at the state level long before he ever decided to run for president. And in the early 1960s, against some very entrenched powers who wanted to make sure that white supremacy, and usually that's what it would come down to in the 20th century, which, and particularly in the first half of the 20th century, was about protecting white supremacy. And Jimmy Carter was, really before he became anything, was fighting that kind of county unit system in Georgia in order to make sure that there was some kind of system of one person, one vote.
County unit?
Well, why don't we just say that in New York State, we'll give each county a certain number of votes. And that way, the person who might get the most votes for governor might not get the most counties. The way we decide how we're going to distribute votes is also a long-running American tradition. In Georgia, it was to give the rural areas more distributive power than, say, the urban areas, which they saw as like in Atlanta or Macon or those kinds of places being heavily populated by African Americans. So that's what kind of led to some of the Supreme Court decisions of the 60s that gave us one person, one vote.
And hasn't that, at least some key provisions of that, been undone by the most recent Supreme Court?
Right. That's why I said at the beginning that the fight to decide who gets to vote, how they get to vote, has been a long-running American tradition that has yet to be decided. It is ongoing. And so, I was talking about the rigged election. I don't think there's any evidence that we've got long lines of people crossing the border like we had in the 1800s, say, in some areas of Texas or Louisiana. But the evidence does suggest that voter suppression, voter intimidation, those kinds of things are making a comeback. And that's a very dangerous thing.
Now, the median politicians from Barack Obama on down on the Democratic side seem very keen to convince the American public that election fraud is almost impossible to do. They say that the system is so decentralized that it is not vulnerable to fraud. You say a decentralized system is actually more vulnerable.
I think so. And a presidential election is essentially 50 separate state elections in the District of Columbia, and each one has its own independent rules. Now, I can see the argument that that kind of haphazard way kind of ensures a certain kind of integrity. Sure. But most elections, particularly a presidential election, will come down to just a few states. And so I don't have the kind of perfect voting system. What we have kind of is a system that is decentralized, but it also calls into question who gets to make those decisions at that local level. It's really an issue of count till you win in those kinds of contested elections. And that's where I think the worry comes.
Could you say more about that?
Well, In any given contested election in which one side says this wasn't fair, the question is who gets to decide? Is it a board of commissioners? Is it a? It's going to be someone who's appointed or elected from somebody and is usually a partisan. It's hard to find someone in the political process who's not a partisan. And so we don't have that kind of referee in our system. And that's where the weakness lies, I think, in trying to decide a system so that when we're finished, everybody goes, well, there you go, we're good. We hope that the election itself will take care of it, that there's some kind of a mandate or an easy majority. But when it isn't, there are those kind of lingering questions that it's hard to come to some kind of an agreement based when we have a secret ballot that the moment you place your ballot into this vat, you don't know what happens to it after that. I'm not sure how we're going to come to a remedy, quite frankly, unless you get rid of the secret ballot.
Wow.
I mean,
What do you mean?
Well, if there's a contested election, one way to do it is we all go online. We can see, okay, let's see, Francesca Riana. Okay, yeah, she voted for Joe Jones and Mary Smith. Okay, it's there. But in a, with a secret ballot, which came about in the 1880s, the notion is once we vote, we simply don't have any idea of what happens to it. Now, I think there are very strong reasons to keep our ballot secret. I'm not about to suggest that we shouldn't, but once you have that kind of system in place, it's hard to go back and then try and see how people actually voted without somebody having to make a call one way or the other. Is this ballot properly marked? Well, there's going to be a board there that makes that decision. And that decision is almost always in a partisan way. And so that's what I meant by there's this notion, and it has been kind of endemic in American history. I mean, George Washington, in getting elected to the House of Burgesses, followed a practice he called swilling the planters with bumbo, in other words, buying them a lot of liquor. And the House of Burgesses had to go back and try and create a law to stop that practice from happening. And that's from, you know, George Washington himself, who understood that there's a certain game to be played on Election Day. That has been there from the beginning, and I don't see it going away anytime soon.
Well, Tracy Campbell, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice. Your book, published in 2005, but as relevant today, is Deliver the Vote, The History of Election Fraud and American Political Tradition, 1742 to 2004.
Thanks for having me.
Tracy Campbell is professor of history at the University of Kentucky. Go to writersvoice.net to hear much more of our fascinating conversation with him. And join the conversation yourself. Leave comments there or at our Twitter and Facebook accounts, Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.